You might wonder why sometimes when Geshe-la's here, he refuses to let people do the normal thing, which is prostrate after he sits down. He just refuses to do it. Still refuses? What can I... I mean, he's so humble, I can't believe it. I mean, you just do it. You're normally... And I just think, okay, let people just do what they do. But Geshe-la insists. So then I just... What to do? How kind he is. I forced everybody to do it one time, but the minute I left... He threatened he'd stop coming to teachings if he didn't stop prostrating. So kind of him. All right. Okay. So we're going to talk about the mind, Buddha's model of the mind, or as they call it in Tibetan Buddhist psychology, mind and mental factors. We'll go into this. So the reason we're going to do this, let's get our goal stated, state our purpose for being here together this hour or two to listen to these ideas. Listen to Buddha's view of the mind so we can get better equipped to use with these tools to see our own mind so that we can then begin to unpack it and change it and turn it or to mold it into this amazing shape. As Lama Zopa says, we can mold our mind into any shape we like. So we're going to look into this, which is the heart job of being a Buddhist. So we're doing it so we can find some tools, so we can use these in our daily life, step by baby step, to change our minds, to really transform our minds into whatever shape we like. And why not the best of all, the Buddha would say, the best one is the shape of a Buddha, the Buddha's mind, an enlightened mind, which is a mind of a being who's utterly full of wisdom and utterly full of compassion for sentient beings. So then they're perfectly equipped to benefit sentient beings. So let's think we're doing it for this reason, long-term benefit. I'm going to sing this little prayer that kind of expresses that idea, something like that. Sangye chadam soke chok nam la jantro badu dagni kyab suchi dagi chanyen gipe sonam ki drola penchir sangye drupa shok sangye chadam soke chok nam la jantro badu dagni kyab suchi dagi chanyen gipe sonam ki drola penchir sangye drupa shok sangye chadam dang soke chok nam la jang cho baru dag ni kyab su chi dagi chen yen gi pe sonam ki dro la pen chir sangge dro pa shok. Well, there's lots of different things to say about the mind, so I'll just sort of say a bunch of things so we can get something coherent here. Well, first of all, we have to remember, we're not talking about the brain here. This is not a neuroscience class. Like I like to say, you go interview some amazing Tibetan meditator living in a cave, doing the job of being a Buddhist, doing the job of transforming his mind, and getting rid of all the ego and developing all the marvelous qualities, and you ask him where his brain is, he would not have a clue. He's never heard of a brain. So even if the brain does play a role, which clearly it does, the Buddhist point is you don't need to know about it in order to change yourself, which is kind of interesting. And now maybe in neuroscience, last century, as one scientist said, the greatest finding of the 20th century is that you can change your brain. Like, wow. Well, I'm glad we're catching up with Mr. Buddha. He's been telling us for 2,500 years. So, okay. The mind, Buddha says, the mind is not your brain. The mind is not physical. We have physical. They play a role. Can't argue with that. They're totally interdependent, but it is not the mind. And so how then, if the brain is not the mind, and how do you look at the mind then? Because the normal way we'd look at the mind is with a microscope, we would think. You go to your therapist and you tell them your problems, then they're going to look into your past. They're going to look into the events, look into your chemicals, your DNA, the genes, the genetic, whatever. They're going to look at the external things and the past, because that's where we do look, is it not? To sort out the causes of a problem, because that's the assumption in our culture. So Buddha would say there's nothing wrong with that. Go look into the past. Look at your mummy was kind or mean or whatever. Sure, and your body does play a role. But the main job that Buddha says we need to do is to look at the mind itself. And what that means is basically you start where you are and that's your thoughts. Your thoughts. Your thoughts. Your thoughts. They say in, you know, in Buddhist philosophy there are 64 moments in a finger snap. Probably quicker than Google, not sure, maybe. But certainly, maybe the stopwatches are that quick now, I don't know. When you win the Olympics, 1/1,000,000th of a second, who knows now what it is, it keeps getting smaller. But there's sort of this idea of 64 moments in a finger snap. And so as many moments as there are, the way they describe the mind, is there are as many thoughts that go on. So, but 99% of them, of course, are completely, for us, at the level of instinct, the level of total, virtually instinctive. So programmed, so going so fast, it's impossible to hear them as thoughts. It's almost like a joke to call them thoughts. Because we think of thoughts as just sort of some kind of intelligent choice. I will think this thought, you know. 1 + 1 = 2. That's a thought. Then and this is including also, for the Buddha, it includes all of our emotions. And this is a very big surprise to us. If you think of anger, you do not think of thoughts. You think of a raging person shouting and yelling and punching you in the nose, you know? But it all comes down to thoughts in the mind. This is why you can say the main job of being a Buddhist is, as Lama Yeshe puts it, be your own therapist. It's not a joke. It's not sort of meant to be cute. It's actually the truth, you know. This is so the very first level of Buddhist practice, of course, you've got to control your body and speech, the berserk behavior. If you're berserk with your speech and your body, look at kids who are uncontrolled, it's like a joke to say to them, look at your thoughts and control your thoughts. It's impossible. So for all of us, we've got to harness the energy of our body and speech first, which is like junior school level of practice. Don't kill, don't lie, don't badmouth, don't jump on too many people's partners. Don't eat too much. Don't stuff yourself. It doesn't say that in the 10 things, but it's implied, you know. Harness the energy of our body and speech. Why? Because the thoughts, the mind is beneath the body and speech. That's what runs the body and speech. The body and speech, our behavior, in other words, our physical behavior, are merely the servants of our minds. You can deduce if I'm shouting and the eyes are wide and irrational words coming out my mouth and spit flying, well, she seems to have a problem in her mind, you know. I'm not sitting there feeling peaceful while I'm raging on with my mouth. Not likely. If I punch you in the nose, you can tell I don't have affection for you right now. Unless we're doing kung fu. Kind of get my point. So, okay. The reason we need to look into our mind is because for the Buddha, this is where, as Lama Yeshe puts it, Lama Zopa, this is where the workshop is. But to the Buddha, this is this where you will find the source of all happiness and all suffering. And remember in the Four Noble Truths, he tells us very nicely in the Third Noble Truth, hey baby, you can be free of suffering. There is that potential for every living being. It is the basis of all Buddha's teachings, all Buddha's methodology. This finding of his, this observation and finding of his, not some belief system, that every mind, every sentient being, and the lovely term in Tibetan for a sentient being is a mind possessor. Every mind possessor possesses this natural potential to be utterly free of suffering and its causes, and absolutely full of happiness and its causes. And where you look for that is the mind. So, and when you really get deep into the whole Buddhist philosophical approach to the universe, the mind is, the Buddha would say, you could say this, the creator of all our experiences, individuals, as and collectively. So we need to look into this, but let's look at the different components of this mind of ours so we can begin to understand it, you know? And so, of course, okay, so the first thing, mind is not physical. Okay, fair enough. So then one way of dividing the mind is into two. We have that part of our mind or our consciousness, and we can use these words virtually synonymously, that functions through the medium of the senses, the eyes, the ears, the tongue, the taste, the whatever, the smell, the touch, isn't it? The five senses. That is indeed physical. But the Buddhist view, be precise of it, that the mental consciousness, the sense consciousness is not physical. So it's that part of your mind that functions through the medium of the eyeball, the eardrum, etc., the skin, the nerves, so that we can have sensory experiences. So the eyeball has to be there, obviously, otherwise you won't have a visual experience. But it's not the eyeball that does the experiencing. That's your mind or your consciousness that needs the eyeball to have that experience. That's the way to put it. So, but for the Buddha, and as Lama Yeshe puts it, you know, the senses are really like dumb animals. No, I'm making it this way. Sorry, Swami Yeshi. They're like dumb animals. They have very limited capacity to really cognize anything reasonably. But as Swami Yeshi puts it, we make the body the boss. How we think, experience things through our senses is for us the main factor that determines our choices, our everything, you know. But it's so misleading for the Buddha. And this is what I'm trying to uncover this now and see how the mind works and why that is so. So then you've got your mental consciousness. This is where the workshop is. This is what we have to learn to understand. The mental consciousness. And they don't point there, they point here. Kind of interesting. The mental consciousness. All your thoughts, all your feelings, all the emotions, unconscious, subconscious, instinct, intuition, you name it. All your mathematical, complicated thoughts, your musical thoughts, your cooking thoughts. Because, you know, you don't cook a cake without the thoughts. You can't play the piano without all those musical thoughts. You know, so much in the mind. Then at the same time, it's also all your scientific thoughts, but also your emotional thoughts, all the emotional part of us. Our anger, our fears, our love, our bliss, our kindness, our compassion, our jealousy, our neurosis, our lust, you name it. All the neurotic, all the good, all the happy, all the suffering. All of this is contained in our mental consciousness. So if it's so, as Buddha's pointing out, this radical point he makes, that we can radically change this mind of ours, we can radically get to the root of the causes of suffering, which he says are in the mind, finally, and remove them. It's like outrageous. So that we can have a stable experience of freedom from suffering, and that's the meaning of the word nirvana. It's not some place like heaven. Or flip that over, the stable experience of happiness. That doesn't change into become suffering, which is the way we have happiness now. It lasts for a bit, and then it turns into suffering. We expect that. This is Buddha's point, you know. Okay. So, how would you define the mind? What is it? You know, if this is a really important point too. We need to know what something is if we want to try and discuss it. If we want to say what is a cup, I'd better know exactly what a cup is. I can't just assume. It's that flat, and a definition has two parts. The first part tells you its conventional characteristics. So, what's a cup, Mummy? She'd say, well, darling, it's that flat-bottom clay container with a handle. And I'll go, oh, yeah, I get it. But what does it do? That's the second part of the definition, and that's a crucial piece. That tells you what it does, what its job is, what its function is. Well, sweetheart, it holds my hot water, you know? Indeed, it does. You know, we get the hot water, we pour it in, we prove it holds my hot water, then that is what a cup is. And it's validly that, because we just proved it to be true. So then we can begin to discuss a cup, perfectly reasonably. So for the Buddha, what's the definition of mind? Well, they narrow it down just to two words to keep it really simple, you know, and we can mystify this, but it's not meant to be mystical. The first part of the definition, remember, is the conventional characteristics of the thing. So in the universe, from the Buddha's perspective, the stuff that's made of the physical matter, cups and bodies and clocks and toilets and iPads, and then you've got mental, and it's not physical. Remember, keep remembering that. We take that as our hypothesis here. So then what's the substance of the mind, if you want to give it the word substance, you know? The first part is, they use the term, it's clarity, or it is clear, and it is luminous, or it is luminous. And that indicates that it's not, the main point here, it's not meant to be something cosmic, like luminosity sounds great, or clarity. It just simply means it's not physical. It's not physical. And the second part tells you what it does, its job. And the job of the mind is to cognize. This is a huge point. Now, that's obvious. The job of your mind, what it does, what its function is to cognize. Now, that's a verb, to cognize. Well, that's the same meaning as to know, the mere knowing of something, you know. That's the same as cognize. Or to be aware, the verb to be aware of something. They're all synonymous in Buddhist psychology. That's the job of your mind. Now, obviously, that begs the question, know what, Mummy? Well, darling, Buddha would say, that which exists. And this is such a central point. That which exists. In fact, when you study Buddhist philosophy in more depth, and you learn there are various synonyms for that which exists in the universe. Phenomenon, for example, the word phenomenon. Well, it's different in the definition than in the Western world, which is the materialist world, because phenomenon refers to something physical, not to the Buddha. The other term is an object of knowledge. Another term is existent. Another term is established base. There are four of these synonyms. I think there are more. And they all refer to something that exists. And now this is interesting. The definition of the term existent, which is a synonym for phenomenon, a synonym for an object of knowledge, the definition of an existent is that which can be cognized by mind. So clearly, there's ways of defining what cognition is, we're going to discuss. There's ways of defining what it means to cognize a phenomenon, and it means a valid state of mind, and there's ways of defining very precisely what is valid and what is not. It's a very rigorous system that Buddhist philosophy and psychology has. The same rigor and clarity that we know we need to know piano, cooking, mathematics, is the same discipline and rigor and precision of terms. Which is sort of a surprise if we think of spiritual. We think it's the opposite of this. No way. So, okay. It's kind of interesting then that for the Buddha, and this is getting us to the point now, one point I want to make, that which can be cognized by mind, a valid state of mind, is necessarily that which exists. And that which exists is necessarily that which is cognized by a valid state of mind. So it's axiomatic. That which exists is that which can be cognized by mind. And that which can be cognized by mind is that which exists. And that's what proves it to exist. So in other words, Buddha, for the Buddha, the very nature of the universe, the very existence of all phenomena is determined by mind's cognizing. This is an absolutely central point, you know. Existence is defined by mind's cognizing. And when it comes to really understanding the subtlest level of emptiness, this is the point. So, of course, it's getting to get to this point to understand it. But this mind is absolutely central in Buddhism. It's not some added piece or interesting byproduct. It is the point. It is everything happens in the mind. Buddha would say, without many of you sounding cliched, everything is created by the mind, individual minds. That which exists for us is that which is created by our mind, Buddha would say. And of course, one has to understand that point because it ain't the way we talk in the world. A very different set of assumptions here. So it's a huge one. Absolutely necessary in the long term if we want to get seriously into this approach to life, which of course we don't have to if we don't want to, but if we choose to, we need to know the fundamentals of what the mind is and how it functions, what it is and what it isn't. This is the nuts and bolts of it, you know. It's a crucial thing, central, fundamental, necessary in the long term. Excuse me. Okay, so then let's look at then mental consciousness. Mental consciousness, not the sensory. Well, no, let's first look. I will go, oh, what a lovely cup. You know, that yellow I find quite appealing. The dragon's sort of cute. But generally speaking, that suits my taste. I would say, oh, that's a nice cup. And if I was in a shop, I'd choose that as opposed to like another one maybe, you know? So what we think, of course, isn't it, is that I, with my eyes, am seeing a lovely cup. That's what we think. And we believe this in the world, you know? So let's say some bloke comes along and I think he's ugly. Oh, God, isn't what an ugly bloke? That's Fred. Isn't he horrible? We'll say that. And we'll really believe that our eyes are seeing an ugly shape, an ugly person. So we think he's ugly, you know. All of Fred's ugly because he's got a funny nose or something. But the Buddha's saying, eye consciousness is really, as I said before, it's really limited in its capacity for cognition. It does not know a nice cup. That's nonsense. All it is capable of cognizing is two things, shape and color. Shape and color. That's it. It's really limited. So what happens is, because we are all familiar, when our eyes land on that, we don't have to sort of process it, do we? We don't have to go, oh, what's that, and look up Wikipedia or look up Google and, you know, a yellow thing with a handle. Oh, that's called a cup. Like you do when you get older and you forget people's names. Yes, you have to do that. That we do. This one, no. And talk about 64 moments in a finger snap, quicker than Google, in 1 millisecond, with no space in between, no delay, especially if it's a piece of chocolate cake. object of attachment. There'll be a millisecond, won't there? Not even a, there's no sense of delay. There's no, you know, if you've got that Mac, you get a, the I'm getting the wretched thing all the time. You know, the rainbow. Oh. Between what you, you know, what you press the button and when you get the answer, you know. But no, not with the chocolate cake, not with the ugly Fred, or with the divine Fred for that matter. There's no delay. And what, so what's going on? We can spend the rest of the 2 hours just on this process. It's fascinating. So first of all, the I consciousness lands there. And because of utter familiarity, that's all. We've familiarized our mind since not just this life, Buddha says, but countless past lives with a thing called a cup. You know, a tea holder with a hand, a thing. Pretty quick, you know. So it's very familiar to us. It's okay, this is very fascinating. The way they talk, everything, any sentient being sees, hears, especially these two, the most powerful of the senses, and any other of our senses, what we're doing, in a sense, is instantly we're taking a photo of it. Every second we're taking a photo of it. And it goes into our mind stream. So if it's there already, sort of it reinforces that one. And if it, you know, well, it mostly will be. And obviously it seems new, we'll put it in there. And within a minute, within a second, we're recognizing it a second time, third time. And every millisecond, there's a photo in there. And they're all being, there's processing, you know. And even they say, all the memories in our mind, all the pictures, all the stories, all the dramas, all the memories, all the stuff, all the we call unconscious or whatever, you know. There are all these things stored in the mind from seeing and doing and thinking about and having before. Stored away, billions of little tiny things. And like with a movie, we know a movie is, what is it, 24 seconds per frame? Isn't it? For one, 24 stills, isn't it? 24? 24 stills in one frame. It gives the appearance of moving, doesn't it? It's a great device. But we know very well it's an illusion. It's, don't get all tricky here with illusion, just literally. It's 24 stills going so quick. But it appears like this coherent thing, you know. Well, that's how all of our days, every day, appear to us, if the virtuous karma's ripening. If it's non-virtue, then it all goes jagged and weird and strange and nightmarish movie, you know. All the stuff stored in here, which is how come we can recognize it out there, and then have opinions about it. There's billions of these things stored in our mind. And then we're constantly processing and assessing and liking and not liking and all this stuff. So what happens is, eye consciousness sees this. Within a trillionth of a second, it triggers the information, my computer, my memory bank, the source of everything, my mental consciousness. And up comes the label, within a millisecond. Yellow, dragon, nice, because you're familiar with it, you know it from the past, whatever. Within a millisecond, you've got it. There's a nice yellow cup, you know. Even more ridiculous than that, this is apparently how conceptuality, which is the function of mental consciousness at the gross level that we function at in day-to-day life, this is how it works. This is hilarious. They say it's something like this. Your eye consciousness sees shape and color and then instantaneously triggers your computer. And then what it does, it brings up everything that you know that isn't a cup. Then it eliminates them and comes up with eliminates all the non-cups and then comes up with non-non-cup, which equals cup. That's how your conceptual mind works. Quicker than Google, quicker than any computer. This is the mental consciousness. And this is, the brain needs to function well for that to occur, yes. But animals, little ants with no brains, they're doing the same. Because it's all programming in their consciousness, in their consciousness, in their consciousness. Not the brain. We're not talking programming in the brain. We're talking program in the consciousness. So it's kind of interesting. This was when you study Buddhist psychology in more depth. But it's so complex. I mean, I'm just remembering a little bit of it, you know. You study it. There's one book that is published called by Elizabeth Napper. You read it. You'll really squeeze your brain, I tell you. It's so hard to understand. All the different understandings of conceptuality and the different states of mind and how they function. It's a really quite a complex, fascinating system. And it's been in the Buddhist system for, you know, since developed in the monasteries back in India and then through to Tibet, the same text that they studied 2,000 years ago. This is the model of the mind according to the Buddha. It's very fascinating. Most fascinating. So already knowing, or taking this on board, that your eye consciousness is just seeing shape and color, and all the rest is a story in our mind due to our attachment, aversion, all our different propensities, that then causes Fred, Mary, the cup to appear a certain way to me. In fact, as Lama Zopa says, as they say in Tibet, in Buddhist psychology, the things out there, cups, people, things, cakes, Freds, uglies, beautifuls, you name it, the world, absolutely contrary to what we think, which is that they are definitely set up like that, like it's a movie that someone else made, and that I'm observing it. Ugly Fred, and beautiful this, and gorgeous that. We think it's someone else's movie. Buddha says, no, they're like our own personal movie. Everything we see is each of us has got our own personal projectors. This is me talking, not Lama Zopa. I jumped over what Lama Zopa said, and I forgot it. I'll tell it in a minute. But it's our movie. And so our movie, every second is playing out. Our movie that we did in the past, all the pictures we took, are now playing out. And I'm not kidding you, it's a great analogy for everything as how it appears to us in our life. As they say in Buddhist psychology, the way things appear to us, the way things out there appear to each one of us, is in the aspect of what's in our mind. So if you're angry, you've got a strong propensity for anger, a strong propensity for fear, a strong propensity for jealousy, or for whatever it might be, or for kindness. The same scenario, we know this, appearing to three different people. Even if they just described in words what they're seeing, you'd think they're looking at three different movies. But they're looking at the same movie. We kind of know this. We say it, our mummies told us. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. It's actually exactly what Buddha's saying. It's profound, you know, because ugliness is in the eye of the beholder too. In other words, we, as Lama Zopa puts it, mostly in the world, we don't think that our mind is playing any role at all. We're sitting here like passive recipients of information that somehow is all out there that someone else has planned and organized, you know? We really believe the world is like that. Buddha is saying that how it appears to you, is through the, another way to put it, through the filter of what's in your mind. So a lot of anger in the mind will see the world a certain way all the time. We know that. We kind of know it, but we don't join the dots, you know. The person is very patient, sees the same scenario that someone else would go mad seeing in a very different way. But we know this, but we don't join the dots. We don't get the point. This ought to be enough for us to realize emptiness right there. So the mind is absolutely necessary to know. We have to turn in. But our trouble is when we think of turning in, we think of meditation, we think it's this cosmic, strange, kind of weird thing that happens. We don't think you need to be rigorous and precise and use, you know, clarity and focus to observe the different parts of your mind, meaning all your thoughts, and sort them all out. We think it's sort of like going in and kind of spacing out into this big weird world in there and observing what arises. It's so strange. It's like thinking that being a gardener is you sort of walk into this big forest and get a feeling about it. No, you walk into the forest armed with botany so you know what the hell to do about the forest. So you look into your own mind, armed with Buddha's botany, which is Buddha's model of the mind, so you can begin to sort out this mess in there, to identify what's there, to distinguish one piece from another, so you can begin to do this amazing job of remolding your mind into this amazing person that you are dying to become, basically, which we can become. So mental consciousness. This is where all the thoughts are, all the emotions, all the feelings, all the instincts, all the trillions of stories every single minute about what's out there. So, you know, when we start to understand this, even just theoretically, it's very sobering already, to even remember that how things appear to me out there, that wretched person on the road, that horrible boss, that divine girl, and before we fall into the trap of believing in our own appearances, as Lama Zopa puts it, we realize, hey, let's check the mind here. What's going on, you know? But it all happens so quickly, and we're so addicted to seeing things in the way we believing in what we see, believing in the way our own mind projects onto the outside. So we never question this. And this is happening like a million times a day, you know. So the mind is not physical. You've got mental consciousness and sensory. The sensory are limited in their capacity. Sound can only cognize sound. That's it. Not, wow, there's that divine Miles Davis. I mean, one note of that trumpet, I can see there's Miles Davis. I'll bliss out. No. My ear can only know sound, but it triggers my memory, and Miles Davis is strong in my memory. I haven't forgotten that yet. I pick it up. Boom, there's Miles Davis, you know? And because I'm attached to that sound, I then think it's divine. Only because I have those thoughts in my mind can I even say that. So sensory is limited, so limited. And then the mental consciousness, that's where the workshop is. So what's it made up of? What are the contents of the mental consciousness? All these trillions of thoughts. Instinctive, subtle, gross, you know, emotional, the dramas, all these stories. A concept is basically a story, an assessment of something, a viewpoint, an opinion. That's what a concept is. That's what a thought is. Whether it's a moment of anger, you're a creep. That's a thought. It's an assessment. You're a creep. Just done with a lot of emotion. That's all, and spit and tears coming. It's just an assessment. It's a viewpoint based on a series of assumptions, all in the mind. Packed solid assumptions. Everything in the mind is like that. Highly complex conceptual stories. Highly complex conceptual elaborations about things. So we can divide divide the contents of our mental consciousness at this gross level that we function at into three categories. We've got negative thoughts, positive thoughts, and neutral thoughts. So neutral doesn't mean they're not important. There are thousands of them, and I sort of like to think of them as sort of like the mechanics of my mind. They're the crucial pieces that make you function properly, whether you're a murderer or whether you're a cook. In other words, mindfulness is one of those. Big surprise here, mindfulness. We think it's almost practically a capital M, and it's almost like a religion in itself. This is one of the many, many states of mind that any person to survive needs well, needs to be functioning properly. And actually, Lama Yeshe would always translate it as memory. It's actually referring to short-term memory. That's all. It's a bit disappointing. Oh, I'm doing a short-term memory course. No, we call it mindfulness, you know. But it's just one of these neutral states of mind. Meaning, as Lama Zogong says, thieves need mindfulness. It's not virtuous in its nature. Then you've got lots and lots of those. Concentration. There's many, many of those states of mind that are neither in their nature virtuous or non-virtuous, which means they're neither the cause of happiness or suffering, because a virtuous state of mind in its nature ripens its happiness, and a non-virtuous state of mind ripens its suffering. This is a crucial point that Buddha makes, and this gets us to understand karma, which is also a function of the mind. It's all done by the mind. Karma is a function of the mind. We'll discuss this in a second. So, these neutral ones, doesn't mean they're not important. They're crucial. But they don't have the characteristic of making you happy or suffer. It's a question of how you use them to do what, you know? So if you use it to help you focus your mind so you can become a Buddha, hey, it's a great state. If you use it to become a really good sniper, hey, causes suffering, you know? So there's lots of these. And then you've got the positive and the negative. And there's really crucial, specific functions of these. Indicated a little bit already. And they're both concepts, thoughts, stories, opinions. Surprisingly. So a virtuous one is, you know, to some extent in sync with reality. And I say that because until you realize emptiness, until you've rid the mind of the misconception of self, it'll always be a sense of a dualistic idea of a me. Well, never mind that for now. But the virtuous ones are relatively in sync with reality. But the other quality they have is they're in the nature of peace, of happiness, of contentment. They feel good in the best meaning of the word. They're not disturbing. The other characteristics, the two characteristics of the other states of mind, the negative ones, and this is the stuff we've got to get to learn. They are not in sync with reality in any way. They cause us to live in la-la land. And they're deeply disturbing. They're deeply disturbing. So the vital job we have as a Buddhist practitioner in knowing this model of the mind, using this as our basis, using this as a hypothesis, if you like, learning to understand what the mental consciousness, what the sensory is, what their function is, what are their definitions, what is this, what is that, how it functions, blah, 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 is in order to be able, finally, in our day-to-day life as well as our meditation, to begin to distinguish, use one of the many neutral states of mind called discrimination, which is a type of intelligence that's vital. It's central to our functioning well, that can discriminate between yellow and green, between good and bad, between up and down, between Fred and Mary. This is a necessary state of mind. But also remember, negative people need it too. So in its nature, it's not virtuous. But used well, it's a vital one in the practice of morality and in the practice of being your own therapist. So we need, finally, to discriminate in our own mind between the negative and positive states of mind. Because right now they're like mixed, like water and milk mixed together. On the face of it, we can't tell the difference. And this way of talking about the contents of our mental consciousness, about our emotions and our thoughts, is not how we think in our culture. And why we have to do this discriminating is very obvious for the Buddha. Because the negative ones, he says, are the main cause of all suffering. Period. The main cause. That gets to the root of the problem. So, and first point, therefore we absolutely have to identify them and distinguish them from the virtues and the other lot in the mind. There's thousands of thoughts a second just about, you could practically say. 64 moments in a finger snap. Why are we trying to discriminate? Because we want to try and lessen them and weaken them and eventually remove them from our mind. And this is what will happen finally when we've realized emptiness and then perfected that realization. When you've accomplished your nirvana, that's what you've done. Now all that's left in your mind is the goodness. And lots of the neutral ones as well, because they're necessary to function. But this is the goodness. That's it. Because Buddha says, this is his view, and it's the basis of all his methodology, the basis of all his practice, is that he has discovered from his own direct experience that all beings, all sentient beings, and all mind possessors, possess naturally the potential to rid the mind utterly of the neuroses and develop them utterly in the goodness. It's really a shocking kind of radical point, you know. Like I always joke and say, I go to one of you people who might be a therapist, and I ask you for methods to get rid of all ego, all fear, all delusions, all anger, all, and have infinite love and compassion for every sentient being. You'll be extremely worried about me. And you'll try to calm me down and give me a pill, I'm sure. But this is precisely Buddha's point. I'm telling you, it's precisely Buddha's point. Because it's sort of religion, we hear these words, we can all be free of suffering, we can all achieve our own nirvana, oh wow, far out, you know. We don't hear it. But call it psychology, purposely, which it is. Just he's got a radical, very different view of psychology, that's all, you know. So much more to say, okay? But I think you can ask me some questions on any specific point I've just discussed for clarity of terms or anything you'd like. And then we can go more deep into the negative states and look into their characteristics and how they cause us suffering and how we learn to see them and understand them.
Hi, Romina.
Hello, dearest. Look at you. Haven't seen you for centuries. Where you been? You're living in Florida?
No, in Michigan.
Who?
I live in Michigan.
Oh, you went there for your grandkids. That's right, into freezing old Michigan. Okay. Yeah. From Louisiana, wasn't it? To Michigan. Anyway, darling, I'm happy to see you.
Yeah, when you were talking about neutral, that we have...
Close to the mic.
Pleasant or unpleasant feelings, or some of them you described.
Okay, pleasant and unpleasant feelings belong to the... Okay, that's another discussion. They're not neutral. That's another discussion.
Well, yeah, the neutral is what I want to ask
okay.
you about. So am I understanding you correctly when you're talking about neutral? It's all of this stuff that we just do automatically. We walk, we put one...
No. Not really. No. Well... No, they're not even thoughts. No, because the only reason we put one foot in front of the other automatically is because our mind is running it. If the mind weren't running, the leg would be sitting still. The body's just doing nothing. The body's just walking in a direction because you want to get your breakfast. You want to kill somebody. So, you know, but the mind is intending to do this, intending to go there. That's the thought. The intention to walk to the door is a thought. And that, you could say, I want to walk. You could say, in this simple sense, you could say that's a neutral thing. But actually, when we unpack it, there's always a reason behind it, and therefore, and that's what gives it the character of the type of action it becomes. Well, what are you walking through the door for? Oh, well, I want to kill Fred. So, you know. So neutral means intelligence, mindfulness, discrimination, that the kind of like the mechanics that make you, that if they weren't there, you'd be senile. If you didn't have good memory, you'd be senile. Memory is neither virtuous nor non-virtuous. It can't be. But it's necessary to function. These are all these other ones. They're habits of the body and speech, but they all come from intentions, from the mind. We're going to go into that more deep.
Okay.
Thank okay?
You.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So, all right. Let's go more to this one. Okay. When you study Buddhist psychology, you study a text called The Mind and Mental Factors, or Mind and Awareness, they called it. Lo-rig is the term. Lo-rig, Mind and Awareness. And then it's divided into two parts. The first part of it is sort of what they call it the epistemological model of the mind, which is I began to talk about before, the concept, the senses, the way the concepts, you know, the way they function, this weird way of picking up everything that isn't that and then coming to the conclusion, all these things, the way the actual mind works in a very technical way, the epistemological model of the mind, the way the mind works. Concepts, you know, valid, invalid, sensory, all these different qualities of the actual way the mind works. Then you've got the emotional components of the mind, the states of mind, as we would call them. They call them mental factors. A state of mind is what we call it. And the text that you study has about 51 of these mental factors. There are actually thousands. But these 51 are chosen, and it's from the text way back in the system of India when you're learning to meditate. They were the ones that are necessary in order to understand attachment and lessen the delusion so you can get concentration, so you can get meditation, so you can get focus, so you can realize realizations, blah, blah, blah. There's actually thousands of different states of mind. And they divide into this 51. So there's one group in there, for example. That's called the five always present mental factors. So one of those is called intention, one is attention, one is discrimination, one is feeling. And what's the fifth one? Contact? I can't remember. Maybe that. And these are working, and they're called always present, meaning every millisecond that you're functioning, walking, doing, going, thinking, sitting here, doing that, whether you're crazy or whatever, they're functioning to whatever degree. Intention, attention, discrimination, feeling, and one other one. So feeling is interesting for a start. Feeling is fascinating. Feeling is not the way we think of it, like an emotion, not like that. It's very distinct. There are three categories of feeling. And you could, if you track your day with perfect memory, track it internally, you could divide it into these three categories. You'd have so many moments of happy feelings, variations of them, from vaguely pleasant to the intensest of bliss. Intensest, is there such a word? No, there's not, is there? The most intense? Stages of enormous bliss. You'd have then the other category of states of mind, of feelings, of what's called feeling, is unpleasant feeling, which is the most mild annoyance to the most intense suffering. And then there's ones called pleasant, unpleasant, and indifferent. Neither one nor the other, which is a different meaning of neutral. It's neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Neither pleasant nor unpleasant. So what's fascinating, this is functioning, it's called always present, omnipresent. They're always there. You're either having a pleasant, unpleasant, or a neutral feeling. So, again, fascinating in terms of, this is now in terms of the way Buddha asserts how we come into this world, why we've got these things in our mind, why things happen to us, why I am who I am, who I am. All of this is what he calls the law of karma, and it's run by minds. We use karma in a very mistaken, colloquial way sometimes. But the word really, the best translation for it is the word intention. It almost seems like a joke, though, because when they're so instinctive, it doesn't really seem like a thing like, oh, I think I will do something. It's virtually instinctive, so many of our so-called intentions. That's the very meaning of the word karma, and that's one of the five always present mental factors, intention. And it's running us every second. Every millisecond, intention is there for us. And it happens all so quickly, so quickly. So, intention, the feeling one is very fascinating. Any moment of a pleasant feeling that you can have, in say in a day, remember those 64 moments of the finger snap, every one of those moments is a fruit of a seed you planted in your mental consciousness, in this river of mental moments called your consciousness, from countless lives ago. Every one of those pleasant feelings is necessarily the fruit of a virtuous karmic seed you planted, which would have been when you did something with your speech or your body based upon a virtuous motivation. That's called a virtuous action, whether it includes merely your mind or your body and speech as well. Starts with the mind, with the virtuous intention. With the intention to do it, and you do it with your body and speech, and it's motivated by a virtue. That's called a virtuous action. And that, again, many millions of moments of these, and they're sowing, they're popping little seeds in your little kind of bank, you know. And then every second of a pleasant feeling, every seconds of pleasant feelings, every moments of pleasant feelings that you have are fruits of those virtues. Now, that's a big surprise. Because I'm convinced, aren't I, when I see that brown triangle, and then attachment rises in my mind millisecond later, one of the deluded states of mind, the lying states of mind, the misconceptions, the negative states of mind, because of familiarity with that brown triangle, it triggers the memory of having had it before, all in a millisecond, it triggers the name of it, chocolate cake, it triggers attachment, which instantly takes over the whole scenario, which makes me all excited, anticipating, and then I see this delicious divine thing out there, and I shove it in the mouth. I'm convinced that pleasant feeling comes from the cake. Wrong. It's very simple. The cake has no power at all, period, from its own side, to ever cause happiness or suffering or anything else. It simply doesn't. So the main cause of happiness is the fact that I have some seeds in my bank. My virtuous seed bank, my virtuous seed vault. The cake, because we're these deluded beings with these senses, and we're habituated with the external objects, and we have all these wrong views about the external objects, and we're deeply habituated in the belief that the cake, because it looks so divine, and what makes it look divine is my attachment. I've got my rose-colored spectacles on. It looks divine. I totally believe it. I'm feeling hungry and desperate and needy, and I don't know how to get happiness except to shove the cake in. What it does literally is trigger. It triggers. It's like a little trigger. It triggers a virtuous seed to ripen. If you're fortunate enough to have some. So this is what samsara. We believe happiness comes from the cake and the Fred and the this and the that. And we believe the suffering feelings comes when Fred looks at me, ugly. I believe he caused me suffering. He did not. He just triggered my negative karmic seed, which is the feeling of unhappy feeling, which is the fruit, one little fruit, as many moments as I've got is as many fruits. Of a negative action I did in the past that saved away in my bank vault. That is now triggered and whoop, 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 the system all happens, boom, boom, all on its own. This is not punishment, it's not reward, no one's running it, it's a natural law, it runs itself. Up comes my suffering. This is why, for a highly evolved being who's rid the mind of all deluded seeds and delusions, you can punch him in the nose till the cows come home. And I'm not joking here. They don't have any non-virtuous seeds. They're not going to get unhappy. They get the hell out of your way. You're a bit of a maniac. They don't want you to harm yourself, so they'll try and get out of your way. They get blood out of their nose, but their mind is not disturbed. because they don't have any non-virtuous karmic seeds left. And this is what Buddha says we're all capable of. Ridding the mind of all the non-virtuous karmic seeds. So then you're, you know, up in the mountains laughing, as Lama Yeshe said, about Milarepa. Are we communicating here? It sure is different from how we thought. This is Buddha's view, okay? But it takes time to see this. And you'll never see it if you don't know the words. Because it doesn't appear this. This is a brand new interpretation. I'm a sucker for my food, you know? I can resist a boy now. They're done. Finished. But I can't resist food. I can still see, oh, there it is. It'll make me happy, you know? Still believe in it. Old habit. Get excited. My nice cafe latte in the morning, all anticipating while I'm doing my prayers upstairs. Can't wait to get down there to make my coffee, hoping that Robbie bought me the right milk. Hoping that Sarah bought me the light roast beans, not the dark roast. Hoping I got my nice creamed honey there to put in it. Hoping Robbie's fixed his microwave so I have to cook it in a pot so it falls over and boils over. My milk. Are you getting my point here? I try to be a good nun, you know, do my practice, but there I am. My mind, what's I thinking of? My cafe latte. And then I go down and I discover they've got 2% milk. Oh, my God. Well, Robbie has no milk. He doesn't drink milk, period, you know. Oh, you kind of get my drift here. So this is so fascinating for me, this one. Every second of the day, you're having a pleasant, an unpleasant, or an indifferent feeling. It's just how it is. They're always present, as long as you're conscious. And every one of them is the fruiting of a seed you planted in your mind. So don't blame the cake, and don't blame Fred. This is outrageous, isn't it? And technically, it's not complicated. But fascinating. And if you start to use this interpretation of your experiences, this is what we need to do. This is why we need, if we say we're Buddhist, well, we need to learn the words of what he says, because there's a different view from ours, you know. And this is what being in samsara means, being complete junkie for the body to feel good. This bag of bones, you know. And as far as we know, since we're born, what makes it feel good is the object of the senses, first and foremost. So we spend our lives, isn't it, trying to placate our senses. Believing utterly, without question, that that's happiness. Because and that's what a good feeling is. We are desperate. We're junkies for good feelings every second. And this is the way to put it. The only way we know how to trigger a good feeling, which is not coming from the cake, but from the mind. A feeling is in the mind. The only way we know how to trigger a good feeling is to put the cake in the mouth. Isn't it? To touch Fred. To hear and even as we look into our minds more deeply, the deepest attachment we have. The absolute belief that praise, good words, nice words with my name in it is one of the causes of happiness. That people thinking I'm a good person is another cause of happiness. But having comfortable feelings is what happiness is. Not even just cause of happiness, is what happiness is. So we spend our lives manipulating, not just to get the gross objects of the senses, but underneath it and more profoundly, and it's harder to see, constantly, desperately, yearning, needing praise, good reputation, people liking me, nice things, nice pleasant, nice that. Constant. It's like we're junkies supporting a habit all day, every day of our lives, Buddha says. We should be weeping in compassion for ourselves. Excuse me. This is the thing Buddha says about the mind, so fascinating. But actually, he's saying, technically, literally, mind, consciousness, this non-physical energy, where it's finally unencumbered by all the junk, when you remove from your mind all the junk, and this itself is a shocking point, there's no model of the mind in our culture that would dare assert that you could utterly be free of anger, free of depression, guilt, jealousy, low self-esteem, ego. It sounds like insanity. But this is Buddha's point. That when you have done that job, because you have, this is realized emptiness, perfected the realization, removed all the delusions. There's literally, literally no source of suffering left in your mind. Therefore, literally no source of unhappy feelings. It's an impossibility because you've removed the cause of them. Deluded states of mind, deluded karmic imprints. Literally, literally. So all you've got left is virtue, goodness, love, compassion. Literally, that's it. That's all. That can't, they can't be removed. They are at the core of our being. This is all you have left. So you can only experience virtue, compassion, joy, love, kindness, and guess what? Ridiculous, over the top bliss, joy, fulfillment, happiness, whatever word you like. Hear the words. This is the point of Buddha's practice. And then, of course, as you do this, you get to see the whole world is like living in nightmares, and you can't bear the thought of their suffering, so you never give up helping them as well, which is the compassion wing, the bodhisattva path. I'm prepared to give Buddha a go. I think he's fine. I like Buddha, okay? What I mean is, I've never heard anybody else tell me I can get rid of suffering. Stop being angry, jealous, you don't need it, Rabin, you can go beyond it. We're full of it now. Don't worry, don't hold your breath, it'll be a while. But the fact that someone's got a system that says you can and here's the method, hey, I'm happy. You know, thanks, mate, I'm prepared to work with the Buddha. So far, so good. I'm prepared to find him wrong, too. And that's up to us, you know. So what he's saying in the Four Noble Truths when he talks about the Third Noble Truth, he says, he's basically stating that this is what the potential of all beings is, all minds, is to be free of suffering, to full of happiness, therefore. That's the nature of mind. That's how it is. Mind is pure in its nature, that's how they say. Okay, so, then he goes to the second, and he looks at that's the Third Noble Truth. There is a freedom from suffering. So if it's true we can be free of suffering and its causes, we better know the First Noble Truth, which is what is suffering. And he lays it out very nicely. So the second kind of suffering, excuse me, is called the suffering of change. And basically, this is very depressing. The second kind of suffering, the first kind of suffering is what we mean by suffering, the ugly things happening, punches in the nose, all the negative seeds ripening as unhappy feelings. This one we get, okay? We don't like this one. We spend our lives trying to avoid what we think are the causes, which is mean friends and ugly cups of coffee, you know? Get my point. So now the second kind of suffering is really depressing because he calls it the suffering of change, and I'll explain this in a minute, and all it's referring to is the present feelings, what we call happiness. I mean, it's like so mean of him. He calls it the subtler, more pervasive, more terrible level of suffering. This is feel like you've got nowhere to turn when you hear this, you know. But we've got to understand technically what he's saying, that it makes sense. It just takes time to think about it. He is saying, it's fine to have a friend and to be in love with Fred, to feel good feelings. It's great to enjoy your cake and have a trigger a good feeling. Aren't you fortunate? At least we can trigger some good feelings. But all he's pointing out, what he calls it the suffering of change, what he's implying is the happiness, because it's what we call happiness, but he says it's actually a subtler level of suffering because it changes into suffering. Now, we know that, but it seems mean of him to point it out. You understand? It seems so kind of like he's just being mean, you know? Basically, he's saying, listen, people, if chocolate cake actually is in its nature the cause of happiness, please hear the word simply, then it's logical, Rabina, that the more you eat it, the happier you'll get. And this is logical, but how annoying, because we know it's not true. We know the more you eat, at some point, it's going to seem like happiness is increasing. But this is the point, when you start to look at it more clearly, start to meditate more carefully, start to look at this experience, you have to see it is not happiness, it's distress. It's anticipating, it's an experience of constantly waiting for the happiness to come. That's why you keep putting another mouthful in. Because if it were happiness already, you'd sit back and go, oh, that's great. Oh, blissful cake, thank you. More? No, I don't need more, I'm happy. You would. But we don't. We have the next mouthful because already it was like with my coffee. In the morning, with my coffee, I tell you. You know, you get older, there's few things that make you happy anymore, isn't it? But my coffee is still the one I'm holding out for. My cafe latte is the one I hold out for. So when I'm hungry in the morning, okay, and I have my coffee, and there it is, all the nice creamy, and the honey's right, and the temperature's right, and everything. I've got my iPad ready to read my news. And then I'm drinking it. It's delicious. And you know what I'm doing? I'm already thinking, oh, I better make another one. And I haven't even finished this one. Do you understand? One of my sisters, and I love my sister, she's got 7 babies, and she loved having babies. And she was attached. It's okay. It's just the way we all are as humans. It's okay. It's okay. It's just the way we all are. She said she was in the hospital having given birth to her 6th. The baby wasn't there, and there was a woman next to her feeding her baby. What's the word? What's the polite word for feeding a baby? Nursing her baby. Thank you. I was going to say suckling, but isn't that what's very polite, is it? Suckling her baby. So she's sitting there. The woman next to my sister is feeding her baby. And my sister looks over and has this deep, aching yearning for another baby. And she's just given birth to her 6th. That's how attachment works. There's this fellow I read about, you know, a sex addict. This fellow who's addicted to having sex with girls, you know, and so distressed about it, just obsessed all the time. And as he said, as I'm on this girl, I'm still going to be on that girl. Already he's waiting for the next one. That's how attachment works. This is a gross level of attachment. In other words, you're not actually enjoying the cake. But partially we are, but there's this distress there. And the point is, it's the anticipating. Maybe the next mouthful will bring the satisfaction that I want. And we know that if you kept following that and eating it, you would vomit. It's a fact. So, of course, we've learned discipline. We don't do that. And mostly that's because we're attached to not being fat. But we want to be thin, or we want to not be fat. I mean, whatever the words are, just being normal human. We're all human. Join the club, people. So look, Buddha says, this is a very distressing scenario, you know. But we are so addicted to this, we don't know any other way, so it seems kind of cruel for him to point it out. So what he's getting at is this point. He calls it the suffering of change, which we sort of know, like I said, but we don't get the point. What he's doing is inferring the happiness that he has found from his own experience and which he's pointing out that we are all capable of, which is happiness that doesn't change into suffering. And this sounds so boring to us because it's not the happiness that depends upon a cake or on Fred. It's the natural potential of your own mind and the method for cultivating it. Okay, we think happiness is what you get when you get the cake. He says happiness is what you get as and when you give up attachment and the other delusions. It's the consequence, in other words. So the method for Buddha to give up happiness, to get happiness, is to give up attachment. The method to have stable happiness, stable joy, which is the very nature of your own mental consciousness, you get that as and when, and it keeps increasing, as and when you lessen the pollution. You lessen the attachment, lessen the fears, lessen the jealousy, lessen the anger, lessen the depression, lessen the ego, eventually realize emptiness, and lessen it all and rid the mind of it. Utterly, what you've now got is happiness that is stable and that doesn't change into suffering, which is the only happiness we know. So it's a simple technical point. But just that we haven't got reference points like this in our culture. So we've got to think about it. We've got to think about it, babies. We've just got to think about it. Not hear it as religion, which is how we hear it, you know. Holy and religious. And it sounds so boring. Who wants holy happiness? Nobody, you know. You understand? Are we communicating? Okay. So ask me some questions. Ask me some questions, people. Anything? We've got so much I want to talk about. We've got another day, haven't we? Oh, good. Oh, thank goodness. I can slow down. Okay. Any questions?
Yeah. Hi, Venerable.
Yes, sweetheart.
I was wondering if you think that the amount of suffering in the world,
the
amount of suffering in the world,
yeah,
is something that is increasing over time, or is it a set amount?
What do you mean by that, darling? A set amount?
Like, for
what
instance,
do you mean, sweetheart?
The amount of pain that people experience in animals, like with meat farming and like the ecosystems that animals live in, the habitats being destroyed. Do you think that maybe the amount of suffering in the world is increasing, or is it just a set amount that goes through, you know, like a cosine, I'm just thinking of math now, like a function that goes up and down?
So you're talking just the human realm for a start. You're talking humans mostly now. You're talking animals as well.
Animals
as
well.
And humans.
Mainly animals. I think that they're experiencing way more suffering.
Do you think? No, I think you're being too human-centered. You're just talking about the animals that humans harm. Lions have been eating buffaloes for breakfast for a long time. But we don't, you see, the tragedy is we don't think that's suffering. And this is a bit, for me, a bit embarrassing to have to admit, us humans. We only think animals suffer if we harm them. You're not wrong. Humans do terrible harm to animals. Dreadful. But we never think that the buffalo and the lion are suffering. We, in fact, bring the kids in to look at nature. We call it nature. But if that, I mean, but if it was a human doing one of those things in the pig factories, we'd call it mental torture. You'd send your child to a therapist. So this is a very interesting point. Would you not agree with what I'm making here? This is not answering your point yet, but we're looking at it, what suffering actually is. So the Buddha's big deal about suffering, if we just look at the humans and the animals, is that, yes, in a way, the irony of this world that we have, which if we look at the 1% of us who have reasonable houses and reasonable wealth and, you know, you understand, actually suffering is increasing, and it's the suffering of attachment, the suffering of greed, the suffering of having more delicious things, but we value them less and less. So it's kind of like an ironic sort of suffering, a sad suffering. So it's not the suffering of not having something. We've got so much that we just treat it like crap, you know. That is a sign of really much more suffering, much more distressed minds. In other words, when I read in the 2010 figures that Newsweek did an interview, a story, and this blows my mind, I keep saying it, so they did numbers on all the unnatural deaths among humans in 2010. All the unnatural deaths, like terrorism and wars and violence and all this, right? 680,000 on Earth. There were 880,000 suicides that same year. So that is an indicator of unbearable suffering, but not the gross kind of suffering, the subtler one of the suffering of delusions. This is the way Buddha would talk, the suffering we're talking here, of delusional and misery and dissatisfaction and anger and fears and depression and violence and psychosis, which is what brings the gross suffering, you know. And in animals, animals, yes, are being more harmed by humans now because we've got more technology. But animals themselves, having their tortured minds, what Buddha would say, deeply tortured, intensely suffering, ignorant minds, living in paranoia and fear every day, they've been very nicely harming themselves, each other, for a long, long time. And I don't think that's increasing. That's always the same. But we don't think of that as suffering. Do you see what I'm saying here? So the key to it is to understand more the delusions, yes. But it's interesting. I remember I was watching one of those, you know, films, documentaries you see on PBS and different things. And there was one I saw from the BBC that it was about even like 200 years ago in France, this, you know, the stinking, filthy, disgusting, repulsive environments that people lived in. Even that fancy big palace that Marie Antoinette and her husband lived in. What was that? I don't know his name. So Versailles, it apparently was like a filthy, stinking sewer. People all pigs and shit. People shit on the street and shit on in the stinking, filthy, disgusting, like the worst physical environment you could even imagine. I didn't know. They used to have a fantasy of big palaces. Everyone was filthy and stinking. People were dying of the most incredible pollution. Throats, where they did all the skinning of the animals, and the rivers were unbelievable. The Thames apparently was like, people were dying from the water. They're drinking it and pissing it and shitting in it, you know. The filth of environmental sickness. Okay, at the moment now it's more dire and it's more big and it's more global because it's more sophisticated. But things like this, excuse me, I mean, we wouldn't even survive. They said people were dying. You get hideous illnesses just by living in these places, you know. That's in a big city, Paris, apparently one of the filthiest cities on earth. You couldn't even imagine the filth, the way he talked about it. That was a big surprise to me. I had no idea. So, I don't know, suffering seems pretty... What, Wendy? Yeah.
Kings and royal families in all of the European countries used to take tours to all their properties throughout the year
And to do what?
Parties and guests there, and they left them because the smell of the sewers
was so disgusting.
The latrines were so disgusting.
There you go.
Very
fascinating.
And then they would go on to their next property.
And then filthy that one up. So it's kind of interesting. Anyway, whatever, I'm just saying some things, you know. But as for a finite amount of suffering, because, I mean, remember Buddha's view, I don't know if you know Buddha's teachings or not, but, you know, he says that humans are like a miniature percentage of all sentient beings. Animals are a few more. We can see there's quite a few trillions of them, and probably countless if you think of all the insects and all the creatures and all the little bugs, you know. And some of these creatures have like a million babies a day. So there's an awful lot of them, and they're all sentient beings. So we can see all those. They're really suffering. And even they say in the Buddhist text that we all know is that the earth is two-thirds water or something?
Yeah.
Two-thirds ocean? Well, you know, the Buddha would say there's not an atom of space you won't find suffering, won't find any sentient being. There's everywhere is pervaded by sentient beings. Under our armpits is a zoo, cups, everywhere you go, they're pervaded by sentient beings. Trillions and trillions and countless trillions. So even the oceans, even I remember, I'll never forget this, years ago, 94, when I first came to the States, the New York Times, the Tuesday New York Times, the science pages, was talking about how we are now finding, this is 94, 20 years ago, how we're finding billions of species we'd never known existed in the depths of the ocean where no one would believe sentient beings were because there was no oxygen, and where they're packed solid on top of each other in the depths of darkness. Well, the Buddhist text, not trying to say Buddha's so clever, but the view in the Buddhist view, there's not a single atom of space you won't find sentient beings, and that the deepest of the suffering of the animal realm is these in the depths of the darkness of the ocean, piled high in absolute depths of darkness and ignorance, you know. There's trillions of trillions and trillions. And then you've got, that's still like a tiny percentage. The Buddha would then assert you've got the spirit realm, and they're even more suffering. They're disembodied beings. Their minds are conjoined with air energy, and they're compelled and propelled by attachment, and they're like in a nightmare of suffering. And then you have the biggest bucket loader called the hell realms, and there's even trillions upon trillions upon trillions upon trillions upon trillions more of them, all in the most nightmarish suffering. I mean, Buddha's view is like, my God, talk about apocalypse, you know. Humans are like nothing in comparison. This is what he would say. And this is gross suffering. So, it's been going on for eons, he says. Up and down like yo-yos. So sometimes they say we're in a very degenerate time now where suffering is really intense. But in periods before, and even before this planet, because Buddhism doesn't just talk about this planet, there were times when we were super blissful beings. Everything was light and blissful. There was less suffering in terms of being human, not this planet. And now we're down in the dumps right now in this, basically looking like a bunch of apes with bodies of walking sewers, you know. This is Buddha's view, quite different. So yeah, suffering is increasing. All right? But he says we can be free of it. Otherwise, don't waste your time talking about it. It just gets depressed, you know? Make the most of the sewer. Yes. Okay. Yes, sweetheart. Oh, yeah, go.
Okay. Yeah, my name's Paul.
Paul. Hi, Paul.
When one sees all this suffering...
What, darling?
When one sees...
When one...
Sees...
Yes.
Perceives...
Yes.
All of this suffering...
Yes.
That's very painful.
It is. It is.
That's suffering.
It is. It's not suffering. It becomes... First step has to be complete... Absolute, total revulsion of it. I'm vomiting at another thought of suffering. I cannot stand it, so I'm going to get the hell out of this. That's called renunciation. That gives us enormous energy to change and stop the causes of suffering. And then as we get better and better at that and more energized, and it's enormous that, we then begin to realize everybody is in the same boat, and it becomes the basis of compassion and bodhicitta. Otherwise, we would all kill ourselves. It's true. And they say with the bodhisattvas, they think in terms of eons, and they have such power, such courage, such determination to never give up. Working on themselves, perfecting their own realization so they can become an enlightened being, and never giving up on sentient beings. It's insane if you think about it. It's true. You're absolutely right, Paul. So we are, yeah. So the point is, there's no point in going on about this if... Buddha would be ridiculous, I think. He's just raving on like a maniac about how terrible everything is if he hasn't got a solution. Shut up and get on with it, you know. So the only reason to look at the suffering is because then we've got to say, well, the first one is there is suffering. The second one is there are causes, baby. Hey, what are they? Well, I'm sorry, it's you who did it. past karma and past illusions. I'm the boss. Well, I better do something about it and change. And then the third one is there is a freedom from suffering, and the fourth one is the methods. So it's all there for any of us if we want to check it out. And of course, it's our call. You know, we don't have to follow Buddha's path, you know. But it would be very unfair of him to rave on about it if he didn't have a solution. I completely agree. Yeah.
Hi, Venerable. I just had a question about detachment from the brain and how the fact that the mind's not physical. How would you look, or how would the Buddha look upon the mentally ill, the ones whose brains cannot cognize?
I understand.
And what that translates for their mind.
I understand. Well, the way Buddha would say what mental illness is an extreme amount at any given point of extreme anger, which translates into paranoia, hallucinating that people are harming you, believing that people are harming you, from all the anger, jealousy, intense attachment, like you're out of your brain. I mean, I'm not trying to simplify it. It's an increased amount of these neuroses from having done actions in the past that are ripening for you as nightmares now. So you can say, you can look at the brain and see an indicator of that, but again, like you can see an indicator of a healthy person too. But the point is, it's the consciousness we're talking about. Their thoughts, their emotions, the karmic seeds ripening from the past as nightmares and hallucinations and misery and suffering, or people harming them or whatever, you know. It's still the consciousness we're talking about, and it's the fruit of past negative actions, the Buddha would say.
So the example that really comes to mind is Terry Schiavo.
Who's he?
Terry Schiavo was a woman a few years ago who was kept on life support. Her brain was essentially, you know, shrunk. And she was just, her parents wanted to keep her alive for the longest time. And the whole country got into an uproar about this, religious ministers and so on.
Mm.
And when the brain is...
But what were the mental... you said suffering. How was she expressing her suffering? Could we see the suffering she was having, or just that she was brain dead?
She was more or less brain dead.
Well, then we don't know if she was suffering, though, do we?
Right.
But she might not have been. Her mind was still there, Buddha says. As long as she's breathing, she's at a subtle level of her mind, which is like dream state. So it doesn't follow that she was suffering. So what's your point there? I understand what you're getting to, so go on.
I was just wondering what the absence of the brain functions meant in terms of the mind. I guess my question is sort of the relationship.
Mm.
You keep mentioning that we detach ourselves from the brain.
I didn't say that. I didn't say those words. I'm trying to point... Okay, sorry. What's your name?
Lewis,
okay. All I'm saying is, Buddha's saying, when he says the word mind, all I'm saying is he's not referring to the brain.
Mm-hmm.
He's not saying that you can't see indicators in the brain, that you can't learn immense about, because the brain and the mind, the brain and a person are intimately connected. But this is so fascinating. Okay, one book I read recently called The Undead. This American medical scientist doing research into all the different consequences and implications in the different states as a result of all the farming of organs, you know? And keeping dead bodies alive and this kind of thing, and the enormous conflict that's occurring and contradictions and arguments about exactly what is a living being, what does determine a person is still a person. And many of these doctors now are coming up with so much findings about persons who they think is dead, isn't dead, people coming back to life again, people who are completely dead, leaving their bodies and observing the operation that they're having, you know, all this kind of thing. So much evidence now, which of course fits exactly with the Buddhist view that your consciousness is not physical, and that when you go to sleep, for example, that's your subtle consciousness. And then all with great meditators, when they go through meditation process, they can actually get to a subtler level where you would be brain dead. The brain does not function. There'd be no sign of life, but you've got your conscious at a subtler level. And so there's one doctor, as a result of all these things that are happening, it's a huge thing. He said, I can say with certainty that consciousness is not a function of the brain. I don't know what it is, he said, but from the evidence now, he's saying he can say that. So there's all this conversation, because it's not as simple as saying the person is determined by their brain. You even hear people who've got massive pieces of their brain missing that function totally perfectly. So it's not as simple as, oh, we are the brain. And I think the evidence in the West is indicating there's a minefield in here, you know. Do you see? And all I'm getting at here is Buddha's saying mind isn't your brain. It does play a role. You can't say it doesn't. And you can learn immense amounts. And there's masses of wonderful conversations these days. I don't know if you've looked into this organization called Mind and Life, mindandlife.org. 30 years now, they've been having these amazing meetings of the minds of the Dalai Lama and the Tibetan Buddhist scholars and the Western people, the best brains in the West. Amazing findings coming out of this about, much of the stuff about neuroplasticity is because of the experiments they're doing on the brains of meditators, observing this really amazing conversations, and most have been published, mindandlife.org. Fascinating stuff. It's not as simple as it seems in the West, and many people are getting to see this, you know. So it's a very interesting topic, isn't it? But all I'm getting at is don't ignore your brain. Don't ignore your body. Come on. But the Buddhist approach is to observe your thoughts. And all the techniques in Buddhism are about going towards your thoughts and going into them and then unpacking them and eventually deconstructing and completely removing from our mind all the misconceptions, all the nonsense, all the fears, all the rubbish, which are based in thoughts. Not just some emotional feeling you had through your body. That's just the tip of the iceberg. You see my point?
Yes.
Thank you so much. Yes, back there. Yeah. Back over here, sweetheart. There. Yeah.
Hi. I was wondering if there's a way that you can hurt without suffering.
If you can do what, darling?
Hurt.
How do you mean? Say a bit more, please.
Like physically, or you could think on like a memory of something that pained you physically or emotionally without actually suffering. Like, can you hurt a bodhisattva?
Okay, I'm a bit confused. Can you ask it another way for me? I'm not quite sure what you're saying.
Can somebody punch me in the face and I not suffer?
Oh, of course, yeah, of course. No
okay,
problem.
Cool.
That's what I said before. Because if we can understand this simple logic that in the mind we have this, okay, I didn't go into much detail, but I'll say it briefly here, of the negative states. There's this hierarchy of these negative states of mind, which are the source of suffering, which are adventitious, which means they're not integral to our being, and which can be removed from the mind, which is the process of what a Buddhist is attempting to do in the long term, okay? So there's a hierarchy of these neuroses, these deluded states of mind. The root one, it's known as ignorance, simply, but it's known colloquially as ego-grasping. It's this primordial, panic-stricken, frantic, instinctive grasping at a wrong sense of self, which is so deep inside our bones, we don't even give a name to it in our culture. And on the basis of this, we have this bottomless pit of attachment to get what that I wants, and then rage and anger and depression and fears and despair when it doesn't get what it wants, and then jealousy and all the other rubbish, roughly speaking. This simple hierarchy of these neuroses, and they are the source of all suffering in the long term. So given that we've got this mind now, this deluded mind, in this bag of bones, and because of the intimate relationship between the mind and physical, and because of our nervous system, and because of our ego grasping and our anger and our fears and our worries, even just a pinprick can cause a panic attack, you know. Oh, my God, you know, you cut yourself and you sort of this panic. I know when I cut myself, you see a piece missing. There's this panic of that a piece of me has gone, you know. Or one mosquito takes one tiny type of drop of my blood. This is so much to do, our fears and our dramas. And the suffering is so much to do with the grasping at the self, which seems almost impossible to see. So way to go before we stop feeling suffering. And we have a nervous system where just even the smallest cut triggers, indeed, physical pain. Of course it does. So if I give this example of a highly evolved being on the bodhisattva path, they talk about the compassion wing, you know, this person gone beyond ego, realized emptiness, gone beyond delusions, immense levels of this extraordinary compassion, stably, very powerfully developed, not just sort of like, you know, incidental, really an amazing being. As one Lama said, for that person, cutting off his hand and feeding it to a starving animal is as inconsequential as a leaf falling off a tree. Now that's inconceivable to us. But the logic there is still, he's in a body, the mind is there, it would feel something. But because, and this is where it's hard to imagine, the compassion is so huge. The compassion is so intense, and there's no longer an identity with a sense of self in the neurotic way, that you'd say there might be pain, but it would be irrelevant. And you see, again, suffering isn't so much a question of being pain. Suffering is based on delusions. Suffering is either, you know, because you're freaking out and someone harms you, you panic, you get angry and distressed and have mental breakdown, or the subtler levels of suffering. So it's because, so much because we've got this ego and this fears and this hate and this all the other junk, you know. That's really the source of so much of our suffering. So even another example. I always quote this one. Richard Gere in 2003 invited a bunch of ex-prisoners, all of whom, to New York to meet the Dalai Lama and to talk about, I was working with people in prison at the time, so people like me were invited as well. And there was, he also invited, this very moving meeting, 20 people, Americans, Puerto Rican, I mean American, Americans, black, white, male, female, Puerto Rican, Mexican, whatever. A whole cross-section of United States citizens, all talking about their suffering in prison and their dramas. It was a very nice meeting. They met His Holiness. It was great. He also invited two young Tibetan nuns who'd been abused and sexually abused and tortured in prison. So they're regular little girls. I mean, 20, you know. They're not like highly evolved beings, maybe. But because they have this view of karma, the Buddhist view that we create our own realities, we bring it with us, the delusions, the mind, the practicing of compassion, this is their stuff, right? It's the stuff of their lives. So because they're really practicing this and they're in this outrageous situation, being abused, I mean, of course they suffered. But because they had the view of karma, which means they took responsibility for this experience, and because of this, they were more stable in it, they were more disciplined, they were able to bear it without having mental breakdown, which is what we would think, because they didn't have the thoughts of why is this happening to me and raging and panicked and all the unhappiness we have. And not only that, as they said, and we had compassion for our torturers, because we knew we must have harmed them in the past. So what I'm trying to get at here is, whether it's the one with the hand or these two, what caused them to suffer less is their thoughts. Their mind had changed radically. This is the point I'm trying to make. In other words, the more a person's caught up in ego, the more a person has fear, which is ego, the more there is anger, the more there is jealousy, the more there is depression and despair. That's what is the nightmare. That is what makes even the smallest bit of suffering, you want to go crazy. Do you see what I'm saying? But when your mind is more powerful, your mind is more stable, I'm not even talking about high realizations like the one with the hand. You can work with situations. You can greet them and see them differently. You can reinterpret your situation, which is what brings peace of mind. I mean, brings courage and sanity. It's to do with the mind, mental consciousness. Thoughts. Do you understand?
Yeah. Thank you.
I mean, hey, it's the hardest job we'll ever do. Worth a go, I think. Who else? Some questions? 8:40. Yeah.
Hi, Venerable Rabina. Thank you for being here and your kindness and generosity in being here. I really appreciate it.
Okay.
I just hoping, once again, you could help me with meditation. So when it comes to attachment, I remember about 11 or 12 years ago, you told me, excuse me, that to put the stuff to the test, and I have, and it works, and I believe it, but I still have this attachment that basically says, in my mind, that says, I need to do these things in order to have these realizations, like whatever it may be, any attachment that I have. So, in other words, something that I want to do that I know in my mind. And, you know,
well, darling, can I just get personal here? I mean, you want to go kill and rape people, or what do you want to do?
No.
Well, what then? What's it called? Nice things.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, for example, you know, I told you about anger before, and I say, okay, well, you know, you have this attachment that I need to go, and I need to get angry at these people. I need to express
Okay.
I need to do. I mean, there's 100 things.
I understand, darling. So may I suggest you give yourself a break and go one step at a time, be a bit more humble about it, and know it's a long-term job you're trying to achieve here, baby. And maybe you tick a few boxes and check on the good things that you accomplished this last 10 years and how hard you are working and how right in sitting in this room right now discussing this thing, not out there raping and killing and torturing and shooting people. You ought to be crying with happiness with your progress. So the main problem you've got, which is like the most of us, is the bottomless pit of dissatisfaction, which constantly finds fault. This is our big disease, darling, and we really have to stop it. May I suggest that's the main problem?
No, I think you're right.
One step at a time, you know. We've got to be humble and reasonable with ourselves. But it's very hard because ego is addicted to finding fault. It's just its job. So unless you're keeping some secret torturing from me and rapes and things, it seems to me you're doing a good job. And so this sounds so simple it's embarrassing. But what we have to do is counteract this addiction to finding fault and sit down with intelligence and reasonableness, maybe at the end of the day, and check off some of the good things we've accomplished. It just sounds corny and embarrassing, you know. But it's profound. Because, put it this way, if you haven't improved all these years, then you ought to be worried. You either haven't done the methods properly or they're dumb methods. So you've got to be very rational about it. So, okay, so let's start this conversation fresh. Have you been practicing these years? A little bit.
A little bit.
A little
yes.
bit, okay. And you occasionally try to not harm sentient beings?
Yes.
And you have any vows that you keep?
I did, and then I pretty much junked them for a while.
What do you mean? You mean you went around killing and raping again?
No.
Well then, darling, I don't know, what were these special vows? Did you take a vow not to get angry or something? What was the vow? Excuse me.
Well, yeah, I mean, I...
The first level of vows are no killing. Have you been running around killing sentient beings, have you?
No.
Okay, good, so you kept that vow. That's the most important one. Have you been running around lying to lots of people? A little bit.
Probably, yes.
Okay, you've been lying about your spiritual realizations.
No.
Okay, well, you didn't do a major lie, so you're okay. You didn't cut the root. Have you been stealing things that haven't been given to you, ripping things off, stealing?
No.
Okay. Have you been cheating on other people's partners or on your own partner? Well, that's too personal, maybe. Huh?
Shh. No, I'm just kidding. No.
No? Have you been getting drunk and abusive to people?
No.
Well, I don't know what the bloody vows are you've broken then. What are you talking about? Excuse me, people. We say that in Australia. It's not meant to be rude.
Well, I think, yeah, and
so
I think
please,
you're right.
You really agree. I mean, I'm sorry, it's embarrassing that you're so grossly over-exaggerating your badness. I mean, you're not as bad as you think, so shut up. I mean, I'm not trying to be ridiculous here.
No, you're right.
I mean, seriously, darling.
I think it's impatience. You know.
It's called impatience and it's called dissatisfaction, which is a disease we get born with because we've practiced attachment in the past. I'm never enough. No matter what I get, it's never enough. No matter what I do, it's never enough. It's the nature of being a samsaric sentient being. It's about time we catch it and stop believing it's true. But it's a disease we have. And we buy into it. So that's why you've got to counteract it by saying, I am doing a reasonable job. I am trying to keep my vows. I am doing a little bit of practice. I could do more. Be realistic. But praise what you do, and give equal status to both, and then you can make rational decisions about improving your practice instead of just having guilt, which is not taking responsibility. Are we on track here? Are we communicating here?
Yes.
Thank you, darling. And it's for everybody. I think we recognize. Yeah.
My name's Joy.
George.
So it sounds
you
like...
You say you're George.
Joey.
Joey. Hi, Joey.
It sounds like rejoicement. Is the
there you go, baby.
To
there you go.
Dissatisfaction.
I tell you, it's so embarrassingly simple, but we just kind of scoff at it. You know, oh yeah, we go, no, no, no. But you know what? We're dying for someone else to rejoice in our good qualities. We're dying to hear praise. And then when we hear it, we go, no, 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 it's not true, you know. Say it again. So we really got to grow up and start doing it for ourselves. Quietly, with no one else knowing. It's okay. I did a really good job there. We need to. Oh. Yeah. Who else? Where's the mic? Up here. Oh, down there. You're closer. Too late. You're here. Yes.
Hi.
Hello, darling.
Really nice to have you here.
Good.
I'm becoming very attached to you.
Well, yeah, but only in small doses. It's better, I promise.
Could you talk a little bit about faith? It's
what you mean by it?
Yeah.
What do you mean? How would you define faith?
I was going to explain my question. Well, growing up as a Christian, I was just so willing to be in love with Jesus. He was
wonderful.
Such a good, wonderful person.
Yes, absolutely.
His teachings were so...
Yes.
There was never even a thought not having faith in him.
Exactly.
He existed, and, mm-hmm. and we all should and wanted to
emulate him. I understand exactly.
So if we eat so much cake and get sick and vomit and realize that that's something to get away from,
mm-hmm.
The incentive is to find something else to be attached to that works, that has meaning. So in a roundabout way...
You mean something else? You mean like replace the attachment with something else?
Well,
you mean literally
it's my way of getting to faith. No, I don't literally mean attachment.
No, okay, go on then. Go.
Now I'm attached to Buddha.
Okay.
Wanting to be, I'm using this word very loosely.
I understand.
Can you use your psychology to explain, Buddha's psychology to explain
mm-hmm.
how we develop faith? I know
I understand,
about guru
absolutely.
Devotion,
yep,
the long
absolutely. All these
path,
things. All these things.
But could you just sort of elucidate it in your Rogina
style? I'll try and do what my understanding of it. Yeah, I understand. I remember I was a Catholic, right? And I was I was in love with God. I don't know what I was quite in love with. I wanted to be a nun. I wanted to be a priest. I remember I was so little, I didn't understand the answer when Mummy said no. She can be a nun, she said. I thought, all right. So when I was 12, I was on my knees begging her to let me be a nun. But it was mainly like I was in love with the idea of it, in love with Saint Therese, and she suffered, and she was a nun when she was 12 and 14, and I went to boarding school, I'd go to mass 7 mornings a week, and I'd be kneeling, and I'd put the hairbrush on my head and try and suffer for God. I'd only have one blanket in winter. It was a really... it was huge. At the same time, I was a very naughty girl. It was very odd. I was trying to chase Tony Kinkotter, the greengrocer's son, down the road. My mother freaked out. At the same time, I was being in love with God, so I don't know how they sat together in me, but they did. But the thing was, this huge yearning for something. I think about God, the nature of God. God is everywhere, you know, all these kind of things. So then, we've got heart, in other words. We've got a heart. And in a practical way, you're talking about attachment to something. You're right. You're right. There's two things, you know. You've got to have the nuts and bolts, like we're talking about the mind. This is the stuff we've got to squeeze our brains about, understand the technicalities, know what meditation is, know what the mind is, learn the facts, learn the details of Buddha's view. But meanwhile, yes, it's really helpful to be in love with Buddha. It's helpful to be in love with somebody. I'm meaning very loosely, like you're talking. We have a human heart. I think when you read the stories of the great saints, for example, that's why I yearned to be like Saint Therese, because she's so blissed out with God. I'd go to mass 7 mornings. I knew all the mass in Latin. I was so jealous of the boys, you know. I couldn't be up there doing the mass. That was my pride, of course. But I'd be at mass and I'd wait to have a feeling of being oneness with God. I was yearning for something. So we have a human heart, and it's wonderful to have that. Now, you better choose, but as Pavonka says, you'd better choose your guru very carefully, because you're going to end up like him. So when you think of all the, you see those movies about the Nazis, they were in love with Hitler. So choose the object carefully, baby. Because we've got a human heart, and our big problem is when it's mainly attachment, all la-di-da, big story, then you put a lot of expectations. And then when they don't fulfill your expectations, you get disappointed. And that's when it gets anger. We've got to really be clear what attachment really is. It's a very manipulative, neurotic state of mind. But if we can see it more in terms of love and devotion, look at how marvelous it is when we have a good friend. I don't mean a sex friend. I mean a good friend whom you do love. We can see the benefit, my way of saying it, of an open heart. It opens the heart. Connection with sentient beings is open-heartedness. Love and compassion, all the good qualities, Buddha says. They are in their nature connected to others, and that's what joy and bliss is. So it's only the attachment and the manipulation and the anger and the fears that separates us. Literally, that's what separates us. So it seems to me, then, therefore, when you read the stories of all the great Catholic saints, or you read the stories of the great Buddhist saints, it's the same. There's this incredible relationship they have with the person who represented for them the Buddha, their guru, this one. This is why, as you know, it's a serious topic in the Tibetan Buddhist one, coming from the great tantric models in India. And it's the same as devotion in Jesus. No difference from the point of view of devotion. It's no difference from the devotion in the Hindus. There's no difference. It's a question of the philosophy that behind it and the one you choose to be part of and seeing it as a tool. It's both. It's both a result and a tool, my feeling. When we're all deluded and normal, You have attachment, you have manipulation, you have ego, you have rubbish. As you smash your delusions, you get closer to sentient beings, you feel more happy, therefore you feel more loving, therefore people make you happy and you feel devoted to them, but you put all that too onto your teacher, onto the Guru One, who is for you the actual embodiment of the Buddha, and you train in developing this. And it's a powerful tool to use well and wisely. We need it. We are human beings, you know. We have a heart, we're dying to be loved, as Lama Yeshe put it. And we are human, so we're using that part of ourselves, you know, to open the heart, because it can, when we use it well, it can smash ego and can lead to more love and compassion if it's used well. And that's, again, why emptiness is so powerful. Cutting the ego and the practice of love and compassion and the practice of devotion in the appropriate object, choose them very carefully because you end up like them, using your intelligence, it's a powerful combination, you know. That's my experience. Does that make sense?
Oh, it makes sense. I guess I think I have blind faith, and as
well, you read the story to some
chosen.
Okay, you read the stories.
The right guru.
You read the stories of some of the great yogis, and it's exactly like that. It's the same. So, but it's got to be grounded. It's got to be grounded in intelligence, in wisdom, and you being the boss. And it doesn't contradict. To say all these things, it doesn't contradict. So that's why, you know, we either seem to have in religion either the idea it's blind faith and no basis. Or people tend to think in Buddhism it's sort of no faith and it's all basis. It's all words and you do it yourself and it all seems lonely and like that, you know. But actually when you look at the Tibetan Buddhist system, which is the one of Tantra, which is where bliss and devotion come in hugely at the appropriate time and place in our progression, in our practice, then it's super powerful and super excellent. We've got to be qualified though. Because if it's mainly attachment, which I see in the West so much, we jump in the deep end, and it's all la-di-da on attachment, and then you get attached, and then they disappoint you, then you go sue them. And then people who are coming along who aren't valid teachers, calling themselves teachers, and anybody will believe anything people tell them. So it's very degenerate at times now. So we've got to be really, really careful. But when properly stunned, properly practiced, it's powerful. And they can say, it can bring delusion. You hear all the stories of the great saint stories, the Buddhist saints. You know, you hear the story about Drontompa. You know, you hear the story about, who's it? I always get confused, Tilopa and Naropa. Who was whose disciple? I always forget. Thank you, Wendy. Naropa was Tilopa's guru. Naropa was Tilopa's disciple. Okay, there's this famous story. Is it Lama Yeshe tells the story that Naropa is totally devoted to his Tilopa and he's begging him for initiation every day and Tilopa whacks him around, is mean and nasty and doesn't give him teachings. Oh, we love to hear these stories. One person look at you the wrong way, you're going to sue them. So don't want them too much. So there he is, you know, desperate for realizations, desperate for initiation. And the way Lama Yeshe tells the story, you hear the story all told differently. They're in the desert and then suddenly Tilopa says, time for initiation. And Naropa's got nothing to offer. He wants to offer a mandala. So he gets the dry sand and he pees on it to make it stick together so he can offer the mandala to Tilopa for his initiation. And then he bonks it on his head and he goes into bliss. I mean, we love hearing about stories like this. Well, maybe you don't, but you understand. We love hearing stories about, who's the other one? John Pomba was this devoted student of Atisha, who as a teacher got all rotten and old, he had loose bowels, you know, and then Drontompa, so devoted to him, would get him to, you know, put his shit into his hand. He'd carry his warm shit down the stairs, and he goes into bliss and has a realization of emptiness. Do you understand? This is devotion. This is devotion, baby. This is devotion. Do you understand? Well, you hear about, you know, St. Teresa floating in the sky having ecstasy. That's what I was waiting for. I was reading all these saint stories. I was a little girl at mass waiting for these feelings to come, and they never did. Ever. Ever. I'm still waiting. It's hard work. But the danger of being only attachment, I've seen a number of people who come into Buddhism who from some karma in the past, you could say, have special meditations, experience bliss, they lose their minds, honey. They've got no basis. No basis of understanding where it's all coming from or anything like that. It's a rare person. I've met some who fall into the Dharma, who meet the Guru on the first day, completely devoted, have never any problems, practice solidly, and have a really close relationship. That's unusual. It's usually a rocky road, you know. So if a person has that, keep it in your heart, very secret, and have it, and it's marvelous, but study, practice, and know still that you're the boss. There's no contradiction. You've got to do the work. So put correctly in, it's perfect tool, perfect method. We are human. We have a human heart. And we are dying for someone to be, you know, in other words, we all want to give our heart to somebody. Well, choose a person who's worthy of your heart, baby. Best is to be a Buddha. That's the best person. Then you give them permission to do whatever it is to help you become your Buddha. And then the more you have confidence in them, and look at the word confidence, confide, with faith. Fantastic. But solid as a rock, not airy-fairy in the sky, cross your fingers, hope for the best. Time to go home. 8:57. 3 minutes. Nobody else anymore? Yes, down the back there. Thank you, darling.
Hi, Venerable Urbina.
Hi, sweetheart.
I'm wondering how one becomes truly blissful and happy in the face of the intense suffering.
That comes from giving up your own suffering and having the confidence of bodhicitta to know that if you don't stay perky and happy and help sentient beings, who will, baby? Otherwise, we'll just despair.
The suffering just seems so overwhelming.
It is overwhelming. It is overwhelming. But if you don't do something about it, who will? That's the attitude of the bodhisattva. Okay, it's like this. This is a sort of step-by-step using the... First, you've got to see your own suffering. You see, the thing is, if we haven't looked enough at our own suffering and understood exactly the three kinds of suffering and understand exactly the disgustingness of the delusions which are the cause of it and understand exactly the nightmare of the past negative karma which has created that suffering, to know our own suffering to the point of wanting to vomit at another thought of it, until we've got that level of disgust at our own suffering, only seeing the suffering of others has no basis. It will make us mad. Because there's no wisdom in it. It's not grounded. We have to know. We cannot have compassion without first renunciation of our own suffering, which is like compassion for ourselves, until we're disgusted by our own. But our commonest view is, oh, I'm not suffering, it's only everybody else. And that's not true. In fact, you can't see properly, the Buddha would say, the depth of the suffering of sentient beings until you have done your own, until you've gone deep into your own mind and become absolutely revolted by another moment of it. As Lama Zopa says, you've got renunciation, which is what I'm talking about here, like compassion for yourself. You've got renunciation when just the thought of another moment of attachment in your own mind is so disgusting. It's like using used toilet paper, is one example he uses. So that is a higher realization already. We don't realize how despairing suffering we are because we're mostly only seeing the gross suffering out there. We've got to go deep inside our own minds. Then we will see the depth of the delusions, the neuroses, the attachment, the ego grasping, and when we can sit up day and night and practice, because we can't bear to waste a single second, then we know our own suffering. That gives you the courage to never give up then for the sake of others. Because courage comes from realizing your own and getting rid of the causes. That's what gives bottomless pit of courage and perseverance. Otherwise, it is only despair. So just keep working, baby.
Thank you.
Time to go. Finished. Food for thought. So we'll continue on the same topic tomorrow. We'll see where we go. Okay. All these thoughts we've had, all these seeds we've planted, all these millions of seeds we've planted, just as many of the seeds that have ripened, but the ones that we've planted. So delighted. How amazing. We'll really rejoice for this. And we will renew our confidence, renew our optimism, renew our perseverance, renew our wish to continue never giving up, developing these amazing qualities in our own mind, unbelievable qualities we have, unbelievable potential we have, to have this incredible delight in this and to never give up working on it, to never give up locating the causes of suffering in my own mind and ripping them out and bringing the confidence and courage to never give up working for others. Never give up working. Bodhisattvas think in terms of eons, His Holiness the Dalai Lama says. Slowly, slowly we go towards this. And make compassion, bodhicitta. grow and grow in the hearts of all. Kewaji nyu du dang lama sangge drup gyu ne dro wa chi kyang ma lu pa je yi sa la gu pa sho Jang chob sam chog rin po che, ma kye pa nam kye gyo chi, kye pa nyam pa me pa yang, gong ne gong du pa ba sho. And may we never develop, even for a moment, wrong views towards the deeds of our most precious lamas. With faith and respect gained from seeing their goodness, may their full inspiration flow into our hearts. Okay, thanks everybody.
And we'd also like to rejoice in the sponsors of your visit. For this evening's teachings, we'd like to rejoice in Paul Hagwood. We also have an anonymous sponsor whose dedication is, may all friends, enemies, and strangers who have no true existence find an ocean of bliss. And Richard and Susan Potter, dedicated to His Holiness the Dalai Lama, to the FPMT, and all of our precious and holy teachers, to their long and healthy lives, and may all of their teachings be of immediate benefit to all. May all beings quickly be released from the bondage of their negative karma and delusions.
Not just rejoice, we should say the word delight. Delight.